Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Check it out. This is Todd Terry, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast. Let's do it.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us on this brand new episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. It's a pleasure to be talking directly to you today, and I hope that you're enjoying this season so far. Thanks again for all of your support, as without that, this show just wouldn't be possible. So thank you again. To all those new listeners out there, I'd like to roll out the red carpet to House Culture. We are a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Come and join us over in the main room on Instagram at HouseCultureNet to get yourself connected with the rest of our crew partying across the world. And if you want to get yourself involved in all of our other club culture conversations, make sure you get those fingers dusty by crate digging through our huge back catalogue of episodes. I'm sure there are plenty of familiar names to you in there, as we've chatted to DJ legends such as Paul Oakenfold, Roger Sanchez, Fatboy Slim and David Morales. Fame club promoters like Mike and Claire Manumission, Danny Clockwork and Dawn Hindle from Pike's Hotel, or even the superstars of today and tomorrow, people like Purple Disco Machine and Dan Swindle. However, do not be afraid to press play on those obscure names you might not recognise, as we make sure that all of our guests have an interesting story to share, whether it's Melon Bomb's Scott Gray quitting his job, buying a van and moving to Ibiza, Buckley becoming a viral news sensation when he decided to sell his record collection, or Bongo Ben's exploits with Idris Elba in the toilets at High. Ask no questions. They're all there for your listening pleasure. Now, enough about all of that. What have we got coming up in this episode? Well, it doesn't really get much bigger than this, as I spoke to a DJ, producer, remixer that's gone by many different names over the years, like Royal House, Black Riot, Orange Lemon. Some even call him God. To us, he's the one and only Todd Terry. In our conversation, you'll hear what kind of sounds influenced him early on in his dance music career.
Let the Music Play was like one of the first records I learned how to arrange and do a bass line and what's that sound and what's this. I had like a little drum machine and I used to play the bass line and learn the bass line over and over again. So I never came out the house. My friend's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm making this music thing. I'll see you guys later. And I would never show up later, you know.
What his formative clubbing days were like?
So at 16, I had an ID that was 21, you know, something like that. And we used to go to Roseland, the Roxy and stuff like that, and break dance with each other and have, you know, that whole life. We lied a lot. Just to get into the DJ booth, we said, oh, that's our record playing.
The skills that he's learned that make him a great DJ.
I go back to the days of DJs where you had to play six genres. You play reggae, funk, soul, freestyle, you know, rap, house, disco. You played all of that. in one night.
And what motivates him when he is in the studio?
So I always wanted to make classics, something that will play for 20 years, 30 years. And, you know, I won't just let the record just be plain Jane all the way straight through. I'm going to cut into a bridge part and then this different percussion and then come back to this thing. Like, I'm always trying to make a classic, a classic, a classic, a classic.
So here he is. I hope you can all bow down with me. This is Todd Terry.
House Culture.
Hi Todd, it's an honor to have you on the House Culture podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us. You're a legend within the dance music community, often described as Todd the God because of your influence in terms of productions and remixes, as well as your status as one of house music's true superstar DJs. However, we always want to roll things back on the House Culture podcast and start at the beginning and ask the question, where did you grow up and how did you first discover music?
I grew up in Coney Island, Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. And I discovered, music from my sister blasting music in her bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to always get into the bedroom and she wouldn't let me get into the bedroom so I could dance or whatever. So, when she would leave, I would, go in there and put on the record and listen to it 100 times or whatever. So a lot of records back then was like, James Brown and stuff like that. A lot of funk and soul records.
Yeah. So your sister had good taste then?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And, when you were listening to those as well, like how old were you at that stage?
I want to say I was anywhere from seven to 8 years old, somewhere around there.
Yeah. And so, you were listening to your sister's stuff. Well, at what point were you kind of going out there, saving up your own money, buying your own records?
Yeah, I would say a little bit after that, I saved up, I think it was like 70 cents to go buy a James Brown 45. And I just wanted to play my record on her system and she wouldn't let me. She says, no, can't just keep on coming in here playing this record over and over again. Because I just wanted to play my record,
Yeah.
Then I didn't want to play none of her records. I just wanted to play my one record.
Which James Brown track was it?
I think it was Hot Buttered Popcorn, something like that. I think it was that one. Mm-hmm. Hot Buttered Popcorn, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was all into that.
Cool. And were you building up then after that a bit of a record collection yourself, or how did that work?
No, not really. It kind of, get a record every now and then here and there. But I used to play a little bit of drums for my church. So I got into that stuff. And then I think around 12 or 13 is when I was checking it out again. In between that time, it was more like playing baseball and all types of other sports and hanging out with my friends and stuff like that. And then by 14, 15, there was something called the Bazaar in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. New York. A friend of mine's Larry D. He used to play music there for everybody to dance. And that's when I got into, you can just play music and everybody could dance. That's cool. And then a year after that, he got a mixer. Mm-hmm. So then he was explaining to us that he could go from one record to the other, and that was it. I was done. I was like, wait a minute, you could move that into this thing, and it's mixing the thing, and that was it. That was it. I was into it forever.
Yeah. And what kind of music was he playing at that point?
Well, when he first got the mix and stuff like that, he was just into a lot of like disco and funk and soul type of stuff. But then after that, I got into like the crew with them and we became B-boys. Mm-hmm. So what B-boys do, they're cutting up the breaks back and forth, So we're big fans of Grandmaster Flash, mm-hmm. Theodore, a lot of those DJs was cutting records back and forth. So we wanted to learn how to do all those techniques. So then I got into the technique of being a B-boy, mm-hmm. and cutting up break beats, such as Aerosmith, Toys in the Attic, Jimmy Squire, The Big Beat, Daisy Ladies, Seventh Wonder, Heartbeat, Tanya Gardner. It's like a lot of those records we just cut back and forth. And that was the B-boy era.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely classic tracks you've been mentioning there, like real formative, groundbreaking stuff. To gather all of that together, it's a lot of different genres as well, like that real kind of melting pot of bringing everything together.
Yeah, it was rock and everything, but if it had a breakbeat in it, we was doing it, we was cutting it back and forth. And then we used to MC on top of the breakbeats We had a couple MCs. I was an MC at one point. It was crazy, you know. Right. It was just that life, that style.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, put you know, being together in a crew like that as well. Were you putting on your own parties, events, or you know, people coming down to see you?
Yeah, first when I was, you know, with Larry, you know, we'd do parties, birthday parties, all that type of stuff. And then later on, I got into it and started getting my own equipment. I started doing my own parties. So I was doing sweet 16s, bar mitzvahs. I was just doing anything I could get my hands on. But then I was playing popular music. It wasn't so much cutting records back and forth. It's more like, you know, Prince, Michael Jackson, you know, a lot of the more popular music and stuff. And then from there, I got into playing more electronic stuff, you know, such as anything Arthur Baker did, you know, John Roby, you know, the freestyle era, that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, that freestyle era as well, that was like where that, you know, like you've just mentioned, the real kind of electronic element came in. And, you know, especially with like the drum machines and samplers and that technology kind of democratized it almost and made it accessible to people. You know, were you thinking at that point, I want to get some equipment myself and start creating?
Well, yeah, something like when Let the Music Play came out, that was like where I said, okay, and I got to get equipment. I got to learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. So Let the Music Play was like one of the first records I learned how to arrange and do a bass line and what's that sound and what's this. And I had like a little drum machine and a little DR-55 Roland drum machine. So I would program that and they had to learn how to do it. And I had like a keyboard, Casio CZ-101 or 100, whatever it is. I can't remember it now. It was so long ago. I used to play the bass line and learn the bass line over and over again. So I never came out the house. Once I had the drum machine and the keyboard, and my friend's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm making this music thing. I'll see you guys later. And I would never show up later, you know. You know, in my hood, they used to, yeah, they make fun of me like, man, you doing that music? What are you doing that for? You ain't going to go nowhere with that. You need a band. You need a whole studio and everything. I was like, yeah. Well, I'm going to try to do it at home.
Yeah. I mean, and what was that like, you know, at home? So I take it, you know, you're at home with your folks, with your parents, maybe your family still. Yeah. And, you know, what was their impression of what you were doing? Like, were you just making a lot of noise and they were like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. My mother was like, turn it down. All you do is play the same thing over and over again. And I'm like, I'm learning how to do it. You know, I'm learning how to figure out how to make a record. I'm going to make records. Mom, mm-hmm. She says, yeah, okay, you better finish your schoolwork.
So talk to me about, like, you know, in terms of having that kind of b-boy like mentality, you know, cutting, scratching, chopping, you know, taking different genres and putting them together, you know, at what stage when you were creating did you have like a first success and you started to maybe pass your tunes around and people were playing them, and how did that work?
I don't know. I used to do these kind of tapes with just the drum machine and scratches, you know, scratching the other, you know, records here and there, and try to mix the records in with the drum machine and then go into other thing and then change the beat on the drum machine and do some scratches. It was just like experimenting and stuff like that. But one of the things that I became famous for in my neighborhood was this Axel F thing that I did. Mm. And it sort of was Jimmy Squire big beat. And I played Axel F on top, on the keyboard on top of it, and I gave out cassettes of that. Everybody's like, yo, I play that. And it was like 9 minutes long, and it was like the same thing with scratches and go, and people just wanted to get it from me. It was very silly back then, but it's what, you know, that's what people were just getting into and they thought was kind of cool. And then after that, that's what I really, you know, tried to do the record thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, at this time as well, were you yourself going out as a, you know, a clubber, a punter? Were you on the dance floors, like, absorbing that scene in that area?
Well, as I got older, as I got to like 16, yeah, I guess 16-ish, you know, I started going to studios and stuff like that, just with different people. And then, I used to go to clubs, and I had fake ID. Mm-hmm. So at 16, I had an ID that was 21, you know, something like that. And we used to go to Roseland, you know, 10-8, the Roxy and stuff like that, and break dance with each other and have, you know, that whole life, whatever. So, yeah, we lied a lot to get into things. Then, we, you know, we said that we just to get into the DJ booth, we said, oh, that's our record playing, you know. And the guy believed us and he let us in a booth or whatever. So we met Baby D and Roseland and stuff like that. So it was, you know, a lot of different stories, different places. Yeah.
And like those clubs and that time, you know, what was your passion in terms of music? Was it a bit of everything or was there a certain genre that you were funneling yourself into?
What I was checking out was when I was in like Roseland and a record was playing and the record would have this break. In my mind, I wanted to say, wow, why? It'd be really interesting just to take that break and make a record out of just the break. Mm-hmm. So that was my whole vision, is to do that.
So in terms of kind of you already producing this stuff and, you know, just whatever you wanted to call it at that stage, it was just massive creativity in terms of taking things and putting them together. Like, how did you first discover house music and how did that first come onto your radar?
All right, well, gotta go back to the story. Some of the first records that I did was with this guy, Tony D and Isla's Records. I had like, I don't know how they got to know me or whatever, but they was out of Coney Island and I went there and started working in their studio. And I did a lot of like rap records, the beats and the keyboards. Actually, I produced like MC Search, Bad Boys, you know, Bad Girls. You know, I had tracks with Dougie Fresh, tracks with Houdini, Dynasty and Mimi. You know, Choice of C's. I was the basement guy.
Yeah.
Making beats and doing all that type of stuff. We had some drum machines and stuff we was working on. And from that transaction, I was doing freestyle records at the time too. So I was producing Giggles, Fascination, Isis, working with Little Louie on, you know, Noel, and Cover Girls, all that era. And then I was in my house like a couple of days and my friends used to come over, which was Mike Delgado and one of my boys' Trax. Mm-hmm. And they brung over a cassette. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I pop in the cassette. They go, yo, you got to do stuff like this. And my boy, he's dancing in the house. And he's like, yo, this is it. This is, it's garage. It's funky, you know. And I'm like, oh, OK. To me, it sounds like the same beat all over again, but I'll give it a try. Mm. So I made up these two house things at that time, and one of them was Party People.
Yeah.
And my friends come back and I play for them, they go, yo, this is gonna be the greatest thing ever, yo, and he's dancing around and stuff like that. So that's how I got into house music. But what I sampled on the cassette, I didn't even know who it was.
Yeah.
I was I was sampling Marshall Jefferson, Juan Atkins, Kevin Saunderson, Derek May. I was just sampling them.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really know or care at that time, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, later in life, I found out that, you know, it was horrible to sample people and stuff like that. But it just happened like that.
Yeah. And, you know what I mean? You listen to that Party People track and like it's under Raw House. And, you know, you can just tell that you've heard it. It sounds like you're having so much fun with it.
I was joking around. Uh-huh. I was actually joking around. I was like, oh, he wants something like this. Party People. I just was making fun of my friends, like, in a way, like, are you like this? Like, this is nothing. I could do this. This is nothing, you know? So it was just a funny thing, you know? And then all of a sudden, you know, I got a record deal with it. It was like, oh, crazy. Yeah,
that is nuts.
Yeah.
So putting that track together, I mean, outside of that, playing it to your friends, did you hear that, like, hit a dance floor? Had you given that to any DJs or anything like that? Have you seen what the destruction it could do?
Yeah, one of the first people I gave that to was like Little Louis Vega. He was playing at this club called Heartthrob. He used to drop it. I gave it to like a couple of random DJs and random clubs, and they was like, yo, because remember, they're coming from freestyle too. Mm-hmm. Into house.
Yeah,
so it's almost like all my freestyle buddies went into house because I started doing house. Mm-hmm. So it was just like a era of transition.
Yeah, completely. And you can see, when you look back, you can totally see that kind of, all of those genres, that melting pot, like all kind of coming together and coalescing. And I mean, you know, you said you were having fun with it and you were kind of making fun of it in a way. Like, at what point did it then become like serious? Like, I can do this.
It became serious when they took me to London.
Yeah.
when they said, oh, you're going on tour.
Who's they?
This was Sleeping Bag at the time. Sleeping Bag Records and Fresh Records. That's when I took it kind of more seriously. To me, I was really just trying to make some money and give my mom some money and just buy nice clothes. You know, I didn't really think of anything like that, and quit my job, basically. I was working at a supermarket, and I remember going to the boss at the time, and I said, hey, I'm leaving. He goes, what? Because I was like his favorite worker because I was very meticulous and stuff like that. He's like, no, you're not. He says, get to work. Get to your aisle. Like, you're not going nowhere. I was like, what are you talking about? I'm leaving. I'm quitting. And he's like, no, you can't quit. What do you mean? You can't quit. What are you going to do? I said, I'm making records. I'm making music. He goes, this stuff no good. This no good. You need to come work. Come on, work. Come on. You do. What do you want? You want more money? Here, I give you another $5. And I was like, no, buddy. I'm out. So that's when I got into really deep in the records. And I was in the studio all the time with other people playing a little bit of keyboards, making beats for all types of records. I was just all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. Like that era. And like, what year was that then? Was that like 87, 88?
86, 87.
Yeah, yeah. And like you look at your discography and the output during that time, and there's, you know, there's obviously, we mentioned Party People, there's Can You Party, there's Bango, there's, you know, it's A Day in the Life, like all of those things, and they're all absolutely incredible, but they all came from such a short period of time. Like you were locked in there.
Yeah, I was a maniac because a couple records I got paid for, like one record I got paid $3,000 and that was it. I said, oh, I'm gonna make $1 million next year, and that was it. So I just went for it. I just was like, I went maniac. So I think I had like 30 releases that year or something crazy at that particular point. And even labels are getting mad at me. Oh, this guy's got another record. You just got to, I don't care. It's like, I'm getting this money, you know, I don't care what you say, you know. At that time, I still, you know, I had a gang era where I was in a gang type of stuff when I was, you know, 15, 16. So I still had that mentality, like, you can't tell me nothing unless there was a problem. So, you know, I'm not saying I was the gangster of the industry at that time, but I definitely was aggressive with my way of getting paid not playing around with my money at that time. I was just really focused. Like, you're going to pay me my money right now. You know, I'm carrying a gun and everything. That type of mentality.
Wow. Aggressive negotiations.
Yeah, you know, they wanted it, so don't play around, and, you know, let's do the business and blah, blah, blah. So as soon as they play around me, I would take the record and sell it to somebody else. If they played around one day with me, I go sell it to the label down the block.
No way.
That's what I did. I used to do that, yeah.
Wow, and you mentioned coming to London as well. Like, like, what records at that point, releases had you got under your belt, and were you playing them to audiences over here? Had you already heard other DJs over here playing them and embracing that sound as well?
I heard about the radio stations playing Bango and then Weekend, and that was, you know, I was like, oh, I gotta check this out. So, you know, I went to do the Sleeping Bag tour with it was me, Mantronix, Just Ice, Tila Rock, Nice and Smooth, and Steezo, Cash Money and Marvelous. We all went out for the Sleeping Bag tour. That was the only one that had the dance music. No, me and Joyce Sims. So, and I was mostly all of those guys DJ. Or, you know, the Tila Rock, you know, we have routines, and I'll cut stuff up for T La Rock for the beginning of the show and play his records, and he would perform it. So that was the family. Like, it was just we just killed that tour. One of our first clubs was the WAG. And then we did Brixton Academy, then we did the Fridge. You know, we killed it that year. You know, we was everywhere.
I mean, did you feel that the audiences over here in the UK and in Europe as well, were you feeling that there was a different kind of how they were feeding off of it? What was the difference?
I mean, you guys were more accessible to music. Like, it could be any style, just so long as it's thrown in right and it just sounds arranged, you guys were banging it out, you know. And that was the whole thing. It was just the key of arrangement excitement. And, you know, you guys were dancing all night to all different types of music, as far as hip hop, house, funk, soul. It's just the way you arrange it. So that's what I wanted to get down packed. Like I would have an acapella go into this, then go into that, and, you know, then go to funk and soul. Because I go back to the days of DJs where you had to play six genres.
Yeah,
you play reggae, funk, soul, freestyle, you know, rap, house, disco. You played all of that in one night. You didn't, wasn't just playing house.
And that's like a fantastic foundation for a DJ, isn't it? To be able to like make those changes and those movements and control the dance floor in that way. Yeah, the
transactions of getting, you know, going from a house record with an echo to a reggae record, and everybody goes, oh, you know. So you got to figure that, you know, that's what I used to always figure out, the transactions.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned Bango as well. And we've spoken to Harry Romero on this podcast as well. And he was like, that tune specifically, he said, changed his life. And, you know, in terms of that and, you know, Party People and the other ones as well, there was some there that had like the same beat, but different elements on top.
Like this is what I was teaching a lot of guys around me, you know, such as Harry and you know, Kenny and Louis. It's like, if the beat is good, at least make five records on that same beat. Why not? And then what happens is it becomes like a thing. Mm-hmm. So I used to have an hour of power from every DJ because they was able to mix in all the records together. You know, it's like they had the same groove, and then that section had this same groove, and that section had that same groove. Mm-hmm. So, you know, between, you know, Bango, Can You Party, Back to the Beat, that had the same beat, and then Weekend, Just Want to Dance, and two other records that had the same beat, you know. So it was just the transactions. I was trying to make DJ's transaction lovely, you know, so they just look as good, because if they look really good, they're gonna play it.
Yeah, and it's that kind of almost like a reggae influence in that way of like setting that standard that you know, there's no tunes that have that, you know, that groove,
that rhythm. Yeah, once you got the rhythm, mm-hmm. Play 10 of those records, people are having a good time, and next rhythm, play that type of stuff. Yeah, so it's definitely a, you know, a reggae vibe mentality. Due to, I used to go to VP Records a lot and Jamaica Queens, and I used to hang out with the reggae guys more than anybody else, you know, which was just strange. Everybody's like, oh, you hang out with Oswald and blah, blah, blah. And I say, yeah, that's my boy and everything. We just go up there and just play records for each other.
Yeah.
You know, that was the vibe. It was a digging in the crates of all types of music vibe.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about tracks like, you know, Can You Party and stuff like that. I mean, obviously massive, massive tunes in the kind of what was deemed like the acid house explosion in the UK. You know, the Summer of Love in 88 and the Hacienda and all these types of things. You know, can you tell us about when you first started playing in, you know, those kind of formative acid house music clubs in the UK, like the Hacienda, and what was that experience like for you?
I mean, it was great for me, because I basically, in my mind, I'm just doing my own thing, you know. I'm DJing this way, I'm cutting records in and out, I'm doing my b-boy style in house. Mm-hmm. So I had a great opening for that. Nobody saw people cutting records back and forth in house back then, and then mixing into the next one, and, you know, echoes and cutting in crazy records and bass lines and stuff like that. I was, you know, I'm brought up into having a, you know, action, not just letting a record play for 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more like, what can I do with that record for 8 minutes? You know, can I acapella it and cut back to the beat and cut back to the beginning and then go to this record and cut back into that, you know? So it's just kind of, I try to keep the, you know, the dance floor as interesting as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in terms of that energy and all of those samples and things like that, you know, I'm thinking about A Day in the Life. For me, like my like entry into dance music, I had an older brother. He was well into the rave scene here in the UK, you know, the early 90s. And that track specifically, it's almost like a blueprint for the rave scene in the UK. Like, it's been sampled so many times,
right?
And it was kind of a bit different from those other earlier productions you'd done, because it almost stepped away from the more recognizable samples.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was when I did that record, I thought it was strange. So, you know, because it's a totally different sound. Mm-hmm. It's a totally it was the sound, that stab was totally different than anything else in this world. So, you know, I know, I remember sitting there and I played it over and over. I said, this is weird. this is a weird one, but I think people like weird stuff. So, you know, I'm going to get it put out. Like, I'm going to put it out. I'm going to do it. It's weird. It's different. And, you know, I was the one that I was always into, like, I wanted to take the chances. Mm-hmm. Like, I could have 3 hit records and then I go do the oddest crazy record. You know, I always wanted to do that. That was just always my vibe on a day in a life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, back then you got to realize that samples, that sound sounded so weird.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a weird sound and everyone, and you're sitting there going, that's some weird shit. So.
Cool. And, you know, it's under the moniker Black Riot. And, you know, and obviously at this point you've had like Raw House, Todd Terry Project, you know, Black Riot, all of these different names. Did that give you the flexibility as an artist? What was the reasoning kind of behind all of that?
Well, the reason behind that is because people, they wouldn't let me, like, if I say, so Todd Terry Project was signed to Sleeping Bag. Mm-hmm. And at that time I had a deal with Zomba Music. You know, at the time, Jive Records, whatever. So their thing was like, oh, you only can have this thing and you got to, you know, only put out that name on that label at this time. And I was like, well, that holds me back. So, you know, I can't put out another Todd Terry record. So I said, all right, well, I'm going to put out a different name produced by me and put out. That was back in the days when credits were key. Like, yeah, you look at the credits and blah, blah, blah. Now you don't know who did what and in the record. So I can't do that today. I would love to do that today, but I can't do that today. So that's why I came up with all the different names produced by me, because they wouldn't let me be Todd Terry on 7 different labels. So I had to come up with 7 different names to be on 7 different labels.
And you can maximize your revenue 7 times over.
Get to the $1 million. Get to the million.
Absolutely. And, you know, another one of your names as well, just another one of those classic tracks is Orange Lemon, you know, Dreams of Santa Ana. I mean, you know, I've heard that pitched up, pitched down, normal speed across all different types of sets. It's you know, it obviously takes inspiration from, or is a remake of, or whatever, of, you know, that B-boy classic, Babe Ruth, Mexican. Like what were you trying to achieve with that track? Just tell us about how that came together for you.
Just a version of the Mexican, you know. I the Babe Ruth Mexican, I heard it was also a movie that had the same melody and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then Jelly Bean came out with the Mexican and I think did I come out before that, or he came out before that, whatever. But I just wanted my version of the Mexican. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and my take on it, it's like that's just the way I saw it. I said, you know, I want it to be a hard beat and just that melody. And I want it to have a loud percussion, you know, so it just sounds tough when you play it. So that's what I was trying to just do, a tough version of the Mexican melody.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And, you know, we've kind of talked, touched on, you know, your DJ, your touring career, your productions, whatever, and that, you know, that magic $1 million, at which mm-hmm. point were you like, okay, this is where I'm at. I'm going to be the biggest production guy. I'm going to be the biggest DJ. You know, what was pushing you towards that?
I mean, I don't know if I ever achieved it, but I think I was pretty close with jumping. Mm-hmm. I think that jumping and keep on jumping, that package was where I don't think I could have been touched there.
Yeah, yeah. And when you're saying keep on jumping and that package, obviously, you know, it's keep on jumping, followed up with something going on. And obviously it was the...
Yes, which put it over the top.
Yeah.
So it was jumping as an unreleased project. And then it was, then we went in and did the song, keep on jumping, mm-hmm. and then something going on. So I think that those three, however long that took there, I think I was probably in the top of my game, that I couldn't be beat there.
Yeah. Yeah. And bringing together Jocelyn Brown and Martha Wash, you know, what did it take for you to do that? What was your experience of those vocalists as an individual? And why did you want to work with them? And how did that all come together, those tracks? And...
Well, I always wanted, you know, 2 tons of fun. Mm-hmm. And so that's why Martha Wash was on my mind, because I love Just Us as a record, Just Us, from back in the days in the garage with Larry Levan and all that type of stuff. That was one of the records. I was like, this is banging, you know, like, this is crazy. Like, I want to make a record like that. So, you know, bringing them together was interesting. And doing that record was even more interesting because they both wasn't there.
No way.
Yeah, I had to do both parts at a different time. So Martha Wash, she did, how did I do this record? So keep on jumping in and something going on. Yeah, Martha Wash, I did those parts with her. Mm-hmm. And I sent out for Jocelyn to do her parts over. Mm-hmm. And I put all the pieces together. Like, I just sat there line by line. Who sings this better? That goes there. Who does that better? Why the... How that's going to answer, that goes there. I did that to the end of the 7-minute record. I sat there and did it.
And they put that trust in you. There was no ego on their part.
I don't think they like the idea at all. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think Walter Wash or Jocelyn Brown loved what I did. I don't think. But I think that it when it worked, you know, they just accepted it. But I don't think they loved what I did. They said that I put in some off notes here and there. I was like, well, okay, maybe I missed a couple of notes here and there, but I don't think anybody in the world noticed it with the strength of your voice.
No.
Sometimes it doesn't have to be perfectly on key. It's something about the delivery.
Yeah.
Makes people just go, woo, that girl could sing, you know, so.
Absolutely.
That's what I was going for. I was just going for the feel. No matter what, mm-hmm. you know.
And you know, you mentioned the Paradise Garage there and Larry Levan, and you know, that how that influenced you making this track. It was like, when were these, like 96, I think?
That was 94, 95, 96, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that influence that Larry had on you, like, I'd imagine quite a way back to bring to something that was quite...
I always wanted to get that that Larry vibe where it the music changes, the transactions, the vocals are curving you into another dimension. Like, you know, Larry's production was a body of work. It wasn't just a mix. It was just like making a classic, you know. So I always wanted to make classics, something that will play for 20 years, 30 years, mm-hmm. and that was my goal, and I think I accomplished that with a ton of records, because that's how I think of it. And, you know, I won't just let the record just be plain Jane all the way straight through. I'm going to cut into a bridge part, and then this different percussion, and then come back to this thing. Like, I'm always trying to make a classic.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, thinking of classics, obviously we've got to talk about your remix of Everything But the Girls Missing. I mean, that your remix of it is the definitive version of it, right? It's like you hear it on the radio, it's your version that's playing. How did that track come together? How did it land on your desk? Is it something you pursued? Is it something you were asked to do? Were you invested in it when you did it? What was the story there?
I was doing tons of remixes at that time, and I came across the desk and I was like, oh, I want to do that one. It's a good song. You know, I was always really into the song before anything, you know, and I listened to it and I said, yeah, I'll do that. The song is really good. The song's really good. And my idea, I always wanted to do alternative music with my beats under it. Like, I always had a vision of that. It was me and Mick Jagger, like that crazy, you know, me and Paul Simon, you know, me and Billy Joel. Like, I always wanted to have the alternative on my beats and stuff like that. So that one just came in, and then it was a perfect vibe. I think we did it, took like 3 hours here, and then I fixed it somewhere else and came back and fixed it, and it was done. Like, and I don't think the Atlantic or the artists liked it at first. You know, I think it was just too much of a change for them to have like this beat under their mellow stuff, you know. But I knew that was the vision of what I was wanted to go and portray out there at that particular time. I did such records as The Corrs, Babel, that all had that kind of fusion going on. You know, I like that vibe where it's a kind of like a rock edge record on beats. It just kind of, it reminds me of some of our old records that we used to get into, like The Clash and stuff like that, you know? So I wanted that vibe.
Yeah. And I mean, the journey to that release, like you said, you know, you thought that maybe the artist didn't like it, Atlantic weren't invested in it that much and weren't maybe promoting it. You know, it had like, it seemed to have like a second life almost, like in the beginning. Yeah. Like, how was that for you? Were you pleased when it kind of finally, like, you're like, finally, they've got their heads around this?
Yeah, I think that a lot of radio stations at the time, you know, kind of turned it down. They didn't know what to think of it, you know, this house beat under alternative act. You know, I think they just, it just, their ears couldn't adjust to it at that particular time. And then it kind of grew into them, and it was the number one record.
Yeah.
So that was one of those stranger ones to see build. I think it took like 8 months before, you know, it was just on radio everywhere.
Yeah.
You know? So a little strange, because kind of I thought that dead on and everybody's just going to love this. And they didn't love it. The stations, the label, the whole thing. A lot of guys at the label push, you know, as far as Joey Carvello, Rich Christina, Johnny DiMario, and, you know, they push that record.
Yeah.
They booked it and they pushed it. And then they saw it slowly come up. And then before they know it, they knew it, it was number one.
Trust in Todd. I mean, it's like,
I wish they would trust in me more now. I'm still fighting. I got to fight every day.
But that's the thing, right? I mean, like, you must be producing stuff. And is it ever a surprise when you've made something and you're like, oh, you know, that's derivative, or I'm not invested, I'm not a fan of that, and it's gone out and it's blown up? Or is it often this opposite way, like with the Missing example?
I kind of know it, but I know that the rest of the world doesn't get it sometimes. I definitely know that. I know that they are, you know, I've been turned down a lot of records, and, you know, then I put them out myself and I do well with them. So just, that's why now I kind of just don't hand records to labels no more. I'm just going to do it all myself. And that's the venture that I'm going on this year. Like, I'm going to put out these kind of radio friendly records that I believe are radio friendly, and just push them a little bit more, put some more money into them, and just do my own thing. I don't want to be down with Atlantic Records and Sony and all these labels no more. I'm just going to try to push it myself as hard as I could.
Yeah.
Prove my point.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah, there's a bunch of good music out there. That's what I'm trying to do.
Awesome. And before we come on to that, I mean, like, just picking up on Missing just a little bit more, like, are you still... you know, it's nearly 30 years old, that remix. It's like, are you surprised at its longevity, like the life that it's got out there?
Great songs. Beatles, Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, great songs.
Yeah.
Great songs last forever.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel there's a pressure on you? It's like a bit of an albatross over your neck, or is it, you know, is it open doors for you and like ultimately looked after you and you're at peace with it?
I mean, I did Missing, I did Something Going On, I did Bango, I did Candy Party. I'm not worried. You know, if people don't say that all those was that, if people say I'm a one hit wonder, I don't really know what to say. I hopefully make sure. Oh yeah, yeah, that's all he did.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, yeah. And the people
over that home.
Yeah, exactly. And the people listening to this right now are going to be nodding their heads and being like, you know, the breadth of work that you've got is, you know, you can't argue with it at all. And what it's created in the scene is unquestionable. I mean, so you mentioned like what your future plans are then, you know, in terms of you moving away and like putting more stuff out yourself, you know, is that just to give, because we spoke to a lot of artists and DJs on this, and often the frustration is when you're dealing with a label is that they could be sitting on stuff for so long. And you know, you're creative at the end of the day, and you want to be creating and you want to be putting it out there. Is that generally the frustration that you've had?
Well, yeah, I'm just a little bit mad that I get picked over and they go with this new guy that has no numbers, no nothing, whatever. I think I'm falling into the old black man category, that they don't really want to promote me. They'd rather promote the younger kid, which I understand that. I'm not mad at that. But at the bottom line, it's really, you got to go for the better record. You know, you're going for this kid that just made this track on his computer. He just started and you're worshiping him. Mm-hmm. It's not just regular. They actually are worshiping this kid for this half-assed track.
Yeah.
You know, which is a good track. Don't get me wrong. And they keep on doing that. And that does make me hang when I get picked over for just this random thing that just came out, but it's all good. I guess I got to catch up and be random as hell, I guess, and do something as dumb as the kid did. So I'm there. That's why there's collaborations and stuff like that, just to give it a different face. Mm-hmm. It's the great, the politically correct word I want to use. And that's what I'm doing now on some of these next records. I'm going to play the field a little differently.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we've spoken to Natalie Maddox from the House Gospel Choir on this podcast as well. Like, the work that you've done with them is really interesting and really cool. You know, and is that like, you know, another avenue for you?
Hit records, mm-hmm. But, you know, sat there due to why? Because they went with this other, you know, not so musical track and spent all the money into that. And did they get a longevity out of that? That guy's gone.
Mm.
You know, this is what I'm saying. How are you not going to go with a choir that could perform worldwide? Why are you not promoting them?
Yeah.
That's a real artist. That's something that can turn into Madonna, Michael Jackson, something later on in life. And they just won't do that. They'd just rather go with this mediocre track and spend $90,000 on that instead of $90,000 on House Gospel Choir, which is very, very strange to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't see the business logic in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm talking about. Forget about all the other, you know, stuff. I'm not seeing the business aspect in it.
It's you know, it's not doing the scene any favors either, is it really?
It's destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's destroying it when you do that. I'm not saying not to promote that record, but you should promote the artistry thing a little bit further.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you're working like these days compared to, you know, back in the day, obviously you were cutting, scratching, you know, mixing things together like live when you're like, you know, recording yourself, like doing, you know, those early tracks. Like, how far have you moved in terms of your production process? Obviously, it's a huge shift. But in terms of like how you create stuff now, what's your flow in the studio and how do you work and operate?
My studio is this computer now. It's just Logic. And I took all my old sounds from my old records and I put them into Ultra Beat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's it. I take those sounds and I still just make the same mentality. I just do it out of the computer now. I can sound like the SP-1200 drum machine right out of my computer. So that's, that. So I come up with the track, I do whatever I got to do, and then I send it off to my engineer, Bill Klatt, and he mixes it, and we bang out records.
Bang out records, just like that. It's nice. Yeah, amazing. And I mean, in terms of talking about kind of bang out records and, you know, tunes and things like that, you know, we'll come on to the perfect playlist that you've submitted your tracks for. And this is a Spotify playlist that all of our podcast guests have submitted to. It's, you know, it's huge. It's over 35 hours long, I think, off the top of my head. It's got Yeah, it's just nuts. It's got every person is we've got 5 different themes, which I'll talk to you about, and every person's put in, you know, like a different track based on these themes, and you can find it on Spotify. It's called House Culture Perfect Playlist, and this is where we talk about I'll give you the theme, and I've got your choices here as well, so I can remind you. And you
so just indeed, let's do it as a surprise.
Yeah.
I kind of know what I would pick, but I'm curious to see.
Yeah, you've already mentioned like a few of them actually. So, in terms of like the theme, why you chose that track about that theme, just like a bit of color, you know, info around it would be really cool. So we always start off with the catalyst, like a tune that opened your ears to either electronic music, dance music, house music, and you've mentioned it already. It was Shannon, Let the Music Play. I mean, that obviously popped into your head. We've kind of spoken about it a bit a while back, but you know, what specifically like is memorable about that track for you? Is there a special place where you heard it? Can you remember the first time you heard it and it pricked up your ears? What was your experience with it?
I heard it on a radio station called WKTU, and they played it, and I was like, and I just like, you know, I think my friends were talking. I was like, shut up. And I'm like listening to it, and I'm like, I'm hearing the voice. The voice sounds like beautiful on top of the track, and the sounds were biting into the vocal. Mm-hmm. Ding, 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 ding. And I was like, oh, that's interesting how it's just, they're bouncing off of each other, you know? And I never kind of heard anything like that. And, you know, I was really analyzed into the sounds. I was like, these sounds are like out of this world. Like, how did they make these sounds? And the drums are hard. Do, gah, go, gah, go, go, gah, go, go, gah. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's hip hop now, you know, it's just, you know, sped up with melody and stuff like that. So I was mesmerized by the fusion of those like things together, you know, nice stabby sounds, vocal, nice and airy and smooth, and the beat hit. I said, oh, I gotta do this.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting that you were actually analyzing like that, because you were obviously producing stuff already at that point.
Yeah, it's almost like I zone out the whole world, and I was just like, okay, I got, you know, I'm leaving, guys. I'm going back home to work. You know, like, it's kind of like one of those things. Like, I dropped everything I was doing, and I went to go figure it out, and you know, and I was like waiting. And those times, you know, you had to wait on the radio station for them to say the name of the record before you could even buy it and figure it out. There was no internet to just go and type in a nice song with Let the Music lyrics in it. You could never find it. So I had to keep on standing by the radio, just like waiting for it to come back on again until he tells me the name of the record so I could figure it out and save up money to go buy the vinyl to play it to understand it more.
Yeah.
So that was the whole thing. You're just sitting there at the radio, it's like, damn, why won't they play it? Why won't they play it? You know, and you're waiting around to, oh, they're playing it. Just like really analyzing it. I had my little cassette recorder. I'm trying to record it so I can just, you know, have it for myself. It was just different times.
Yeah. I mean, kids, they don't know the struggle, do they, these days? No, it's nuts.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of that, you know, that production aspect of that, you know, I'm really sitting down and analyzing, like you say, you went, whew, you know, you're locked into it. You know, does anything like that still happen now? You know, is there, do you hear things these days, and do things still surprise you, or do you?
The only other thing that surprised me after Let the Music Play was Kraftwerk. But Kraftwerk was before, actually. That was dope. Like, I couldn't figure out. My whole thing was like, what drum machine is that?
Yeah.
Because that was the whole trick, is to figure out what drum machine are they using. And Kraftwerk had made their own drum machine. you couldn't. So now what do? You want to be like them, but it's impossible to be like them. That's why they, to this day, never could be exactly duplicated at all.
Peerless, absolutely. Cool. Okay, so the next track on the playlist is a floor filler. You know, and this is sometimes, you know, sometimes people approach this differently, you know, either it's a floor filler, like everyone's on the floor, you play the big track, it's all hands in the air. Or sometimes we've had people that have been like, you play that one track where it just changes things from a bit of a warm up to getting people onto the dance floor.
Gotcha.
You've gone big, and it's, well, we've already really covered about it. It's Something Going On by Your Good Self.
The reason why I picked that track for myself, because I had to take myself out of the box that, if I didn't produce that track, I think that still would have been a great record. Mm-hmm. That's why, again, I pick my own records most of the time because I'm stepping out of me, you know, that, okay, this definitely did work for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I'm not just talking out my ass, you know, like, and, you know, just blowing up my head. I'm picking it out the box, not just because of me, but just because of the singers too, you know. So that's the key of why I pick a lot of my stuff. I'm stepping out of myself to pick it. Something Going On, you know, I look at it as you could play it anywhere, I think. And even if a kid never heard it before, the kid would just check it out. Like, what's that record? Mm-hmm. I heard this melody the other day I really like. You know, I think I gave a lot of that to the table. And I noticed, I just played on this boat called the Friendship Boat. And, you know, I played it and I saw a bunch of the kids, right before me, and it was just like, and they're holding, they're going in their phones and stuff like that. And I'm like, this is the end of this record, and they're really checking it out. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they're talking about it. They're talking about the record, and I was just really that really made me happy, actually. Just that they was young and they were just really checking it out.
That's good to hear and good to see. Yeah, it's for me, it's all about that whomp. Hearing that on a sound system is like
the warp. I call that the warp. Whatever a beat is playing and something is just like enhancing the beat, I warped out, you know, warp, you know, that whole thing, just the action, you know, the right type of action on the beat. And that particularly worked really well.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, you said that it is a track by yourself. Do you sometimes feel when you're DJing and playing that there's a pressure or expectation from you, from the crowd, to play stuff that is by you? How does that sit with you?
If I don't play certain records, people get mad. That's why I play the same records on my set. I can see probably other DJs like, oh, he plays the same shit all the time. I'm sorry. I have no other choice. I can't just go into playing something that they don't want to hear. They paid 40, 50 euros to hear me play these records. I am so sorry. So I apologize to anybody that goes, he plays the same thing all the time. I can't, unfortunately, I can't really help it.
Yeah.
It's got to be five or six of them at least.
Yeah. The price of fame.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't get away with it. And I won't do that to my fans. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you don't know who's in that crowd, where they came from to go to the show. You don't, you know, you got to, I try to please everybody. That's what a DJ is supposed to be doing. Not playing 8-minute records and smoking a cigarette. That's black to me, you know.
Yeah, always be busy. And the, okay, so next track is a Sunsetter track to soundtrack A Perfect Sunset. You have chosen Everybody Loves the Sunshine by Roy Ayers. Real change of pace. What's your experience with that, and why did you choose it?
I was in a bar, and I think that came on. Mm-hmm. And I knew his records from back in the days, and for some reason I didn't know that one. And I heard that high synth, and I was like, oh shit, that's like Summer Madness, Cool of the Gang. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. Yeah, that's what, you know, I love music. Mm-hmm. You know, and he took it there. He took it to like music and mood. Yeah. So that particular record, you could be out of sun on a beach just with a drink and put it on, you complete your day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those tunes. Every time I hear, I just see the color yellow for whatever
reason. Oh, that's interesting. I thought about that too. Like, I get a vision when that record comes on. It's orange and yellow.
Yeah.
And, you know, the, you know, perfect beach scene, and you know, you get that whole mood going on with that record.
Yeah.
You have to. There's no other mood to get but that. You know, it creates that. And that high synth sound is the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the sun.
Yeah.
That's what the sun is right there. That's, mm-hmm. that's the sun.
Yeah.
So
brilliant, brilliant track. Thank you for putting that in there. Okay, so next one is a tearjerker. We've already spoken at length about this, but it is Missing by Everything But the Girl, your remix of that. It's an interesting success as well in that, and we've spoken to a few people on the podcast that what they've described as kind of like melancholic dance music. And it's not often, you know, you think of dance music, you think of like disco and that influence that, you know, it's all about high energy, celebration, you know, the coming together, you know, to have something that's like a bit more moody and melancholic is quite rare. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, my vision, you know, let's talk about vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
She creates a mood like no other.
Tracy Thorn, yeah.
Yeah, her voice is like no other. Mm-hmm. Can't be duplicated.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get that rich, like it's dark.
Yeah.
It's dark light. That's what that is.
Yeah.
You know, it's how do you get those two together? That doesn't make no sense at all. But that's what she brings to the table. She brings a dark, sexy light to a beat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty incredible. So that's why I picked that. Not because of me, because of the vocal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gives off a really good feeling. She definitely does.
Okay. Last tune, crowd are asking for one more. You've chosen Let's Dance by David Bowie.
I like that record. I like the horns in that record. I like the echoes. People don't realize that. That's echoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's unique.
Yeah,
nobody's done that before. Now, rock that. Nobody's taking. So some I like picking records where people just take a chance on something.
Mm-hmm.
Not the regular thing. He could have went that 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 that.
Yeah,
but that like. It floated out. Say more. It's you know, I'm always looking for the difference, in something, and that's the difference that made you check it out. And you know, Bowie's vocals. You know, it's like, come on, man. You know, you could see him singing it for the rest of your life. You could just see him singing it.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We always have the one final question that we ask our guests, and obviously we are House Culture, and you're on the House Culture podcast, and you know the whole culture of the scene. You know, what does House Culture kind of mean to you, being a stalwart of that scene, someone who's been there from the very beginning and given us so much? You know, what's the scene given you, and what do you think of House Culture when you look at it?
I mean, I've had some up and downs with the whole house thing. You know, sometimes I loved it. Sometimes I hated it. Sometimes, you know, it just, some parts of EDM ruined it. You know, it's a lot of up and downs. And some, you know, some artists have, you know, taken advantage of our sound because they ran out of things to do, you know, which is what's happening now. Everybody's supposed to go house now because they ran out of, you know, the dumb music is just a lot of dumb music for the last 10 years. So it's like, now everybody wants to come to house because I think they realized the soulfulness of it, and that you are creative, mm-hmm. and that you are making music, and that you are, you got intricate things that nobody else can do or think of. That's, and that, you know, now they want to take our creation to make their pop records, which is fine, which I've done 30 years ago, and nobody wanted to hear that. So I have strange ups and downs in it. But house music in general, we need more songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way for us to go further. And we need these radio stations that are claiming to be house music stations to play the damn songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they won't play them. It's like they keep on doing the same thing over and over, whether it's just a piano track to the end or... You can mix it up. It's nothing wrong with mixing it up. That's why it's house music. That's why it's there for. It's there to be something to give to the world, and you won't let us give it.
Brilliant place to end on. That's a great final thought. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you so much. All right. Peace.
House Culture.
peace. Somehow the Americans do it so much better, don't they? I mean, just wow, what a legend Todd is. I've got to tell you, it's sometimes pretty nerve-wracking chatting to your heroes like that, especially one who is often described as a god. So I want to thank Todd personally for being so accommodating and taking the time to tell us his story. I hope you all enjoyed hearing it. If you want to catch Todd playing live this summer, you can do so at Glitterbox in Ibiza or Defected at Eden. But if you aren't lucky enough to be travelling to the White Isle this summer, you can see Todd in the UK at Camp Bestival on the 27th of July, the Wilderness Festival on the 3rd of August, and the 51st State Festival in London on the 5th of August. Do not miss out. However, even if you're all booked up this season and haven't got room for any more events in your life, make sure you soundtrack your travel plans with the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. This is where you'll hear Todd's fantastic choices, as well as all of the other submissions from our previous podcast guests. Seek it out, shuffle it up, and play it loud. And when you're on Spotify, please also leave us a comment on this episode, which you can do so in the Q&A description underneath the description on your mobile. If you're not on Spotify, there are still no excuses, people, as you can write us up a review on Apple or leave us some feedback on YouTube. Remember, all of the nice ones will get a shout out on a future episode of the show. Which leads me to say a huge hello to James Park, who thought that our chat with Roy Davis Jr. in our last episode was one of his best interviews ever. Thanks so much for that, James. Really great feedback. Roy was a great guest, and we totally agree with you. Even if we do say so ourselves. Now, this is the end of the episode. I'd like to thank you once again for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, if you don't already. And also follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture to stay up to date with all goings on across our community. And I'm always available on Instagram as well. So please follow or get in touch with me directly at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rave safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.